Please turn off all cell phones, including all other electronic devices, while inside the building and put them out of the way of sight so as not to distract others or interfere with the sound equipment. The meeting does not end until after the Lord's Prayer. The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and/or understanding. Good evening. My name is Sean, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers, a coffee break, and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Dave M.
My name is Dave Mackey, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Hilda for asking me to speak here tonight. It's a privilege to be asked at any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel very privileged that I'm sober today. I felt quite different as a child growing up, and there seemed to be reasons for that. I always feel obligated somehow to explain in detail how this all happened. I'm going to cut through it. If you want any details, if you don't understand it, that's fine. I wound up at the age of 12, leaving my family's home in England to live with an aunt and uncle in Northern California, Modoc County, right up on the Oregon-Nevada border. And I became a member of the largest ever graduating class in Surprise Valley Union High School. There were 23 of us. And I wound up graduating from Surprise Valley Union High School at the age of 14. And coming from another country, being different in age, living several miles away from the town on a ranch, that by itself is enough to feel different, I suppose. But I added that by my nature of when I was in the shower after gym class comparing myself with the senior men. And that's one way to establish a feeling of inferiority. Plus the superiority, because I could manage the school work quite well. And I wound up graduating very early. And I wound up after that at 16 years old in Santa Monica College as a 16-year-old, not quite knowing what he was doing with a major, maybe agriculture, but they didn't have an agriculture school. So I really didn't know what I was doing. And shortly after I was 17 years old, I simply dropped out of school. I walked away. I didn't withdraw. I simply dropped a whole bunch of units to be left with an F, and joined the Marine Corps. Seemed to be a good solution to me, although I thought differently about that the moment I landed in boot camp. But at 17, I was in the Marine Corps, and I did not, as many people talk about the Marine Corps being a great ground for starting drinking. I did not immediately. Somehow or other, I got involved with a girl in a church and actually became a Christian Marine for a couple of years until I got transferred on my own request to Japan. And in Japan, I discovered my inferiority complex was not well founded. Perhaps I was more masculine than I thought. And I became quite enthused about going out at night. Uh, And I started drinking, and my drinking became quite heavy. I was not exactly a stranger to drink. I remember my first, perhaps not my first beer, but sitting after working in the hayfields with the men, and they giving me a beer. And I remember putting that down and feeling somehow mature when I put that beer down. Oh, that was a hint perhaps there. But I wound up in the Marine Corps and started my drinking heavily, got discharged from them without any major problems, and started what was to be a gradual cycle into worse drinking. I've always had the tendency, when I start drinking, I love bars. If I go out to a bar, I will close it. And I will usually be drunk. That got me in jail for playing drunk a number of times. Before it got very bad, I actually wound up marrying a woman who made a statement to me. It's an odd story. I met her I won't go into it. I met her when I was 16 years old, and she turned me down for a date. And I found her later in a party. I was quite drunk afterwards, but she went out with me, and I discovered that we had this connection. She had turned me down while I was in my teens, so I got even with her. I married her. She made the statement that she didn't like drunks, and I guess I was able to hide my worst drinking from her, so we did get married. And I thought, perhaps this is an indication of alcoholism too. There's a couple of them. I thought I needed straightening out, and she looked like a pretty straight together person, and that would help me. And part of that being helping me to slow down my drinking, which it did a bit. Although it turned out she was very narrow-minded about drinking. My cleaned-up act still caused her problems. I remember getting that scathing look at just simply going for a beer in the refrigerator after work and just getting a scathing look. You know, and it's a beer, you know, as I have a right to that, I work. And like I say, my fun was out drinking. She suggested to me once that I stop drinking, and I remember considering that seriously for all of 3 or 4 seconds. And I just pushed that thought out of my mind because drinking was too important to me at that time. I did not. Now, like I say, she was pretty narrow-minded. I say, although in her behalf, I describe one incident, perhaps giving her some justification. I came out of, after a night drinking, I woke up in the morning and found her kneeling on the living room floor, and she had two dresser drawers in front of her and was scrubbing them out with soap and water. And I asked her, what the devil was she doing? And she said that I had urinated in those the night before. I had no memory of having done that. I can kind of create that I was probably expressing my views of the world as in general, but I have no memory of doing that. And maybe you can see from this, our marriage was headed for disaster immediately. She left me, and I had mixed feelings about that. One was, how could she? I was a provider. I was working. How could she just leave me like that? And the other was relief, because now I could go back to the fun that I knew. And we started a back-and-forth relationship that was to go on actually several years, seeing each other, sometimes not seeing each other in this. And it culminated it was after one night. I had been drinking the entire night. I never went to bed. I remember that. In my own mind, I was not drunk, although that's perhaps questionable. I stayed up drinking the entire night, and we were going somewhere for the weekend, and I started acting crazy. Again, I'm skipping a lot of details. I was driving a Jaguar sedan. Somebody had convinced me that would up my image of myself. And I got this idea that by the power of my mind, I could make that Jaguar intermolecularly transmigrate through the car in front of it. Now, I'm sure most of you are aware that a solid object like this is not all solid. It's made up mostly of space between the atoms and so forth. So I was going to, through the power that I had achieved in my mind, make those cars intermolecularly transmigrate. If you're looking for that term, don't bother. I coined it myself. She got scared of my behavior at this point. And when we were out of the car, she tried to get away, and I went literally berserk in my mind. I knocked her to the ground. Her skull was fractured in the process. I was handcuffed and put in a nut board. They let me go the next day with relatives. But from that point on, I became obsessed with somehow making up for having hurt her. But my drinking progressed for 3 years after that happened, and I was drinking heavier this time because I was drinking to get over that incident, and my drinking progressed, and I finally came to a last point. I don't remember my last drink. I remember I was at somebody's home, which was getting to be unusual, and I remember my last thought there was that I was behaving all right, which kind of indicates perhaps sometimes I wasn't, and I came to in the morning by the side of the 405, the San Diego freeway in the San Fernando Valley, coming to in the morning. I did something different that morning. I made a call to a sober member, happened to be the Pacific Group, sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I need help with the program. That was my prayer. That was in May the 12th, 1975. I haven't had to drink since then. And I became part of the Pacific Group, but I'm out of time. And thank you for having me share.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Laura Jay.
Laura, I'm an alcoholic. Dave, thank you for your share, and Hilda, thank you very much for asking me. It's really an honor to be here. My sobriety date is September 5th, 2012. Allison R. is my sponsor, and this is my home group. So I am a little bit of a late bloomer. I started drinking when I was about 16. That's when I took my first drink. And I grew up, well, I guess I'll backtrack. I grew up in the South in Nashville, and I grew up in a really happy home. Like, I just did. Like, my parents are still together, and I have siblings that I'm close to, and it wasn't a ton of turmoil. But my sister was an alcoholic, and so I grew up with a lot of crazy with her. And so I thought that drinking, it would get me in trouble, and I wanted to do everything in my power not to do it. And so I didn't for a long time. And then I went to a wedding, and I was really naive growing up. Like, I just was. And, I was at a wedding, and it was a family friend, and, I didn't know alcohol was in champagne. And so I went up and, seriously, really naive. And I had my first sip of champagne at 16, and I loved it. And then I proceeded to have 21 glasses. And I kept going up and up and back and back. And as soon as I had taken that first sip, just like this cool came over my body that we all talk about. And I grew up like really uncomfortable in my skin. I was overweight. I was uncomfortable because of that. I was uncomfortable because I have alcoholism, you know, like it doesn't matter why. Like, the big book tells me like I was probably born like restless, irritable, and discontent. And I was. And so when I took that first drink, it really calmed me. And I just kept going back for more and back for more and back for more. And I remember that I felt embarrassed. I felt demoralized. I felt shame. And that's not normal. People like who are normal drinkers don't feel that when they take their first drink or 21. And so I remember stumbling into the bathroom and there was a woman in there and I was just petrified and I tried to hide and I tried to act like I wasn't throwing up. And I was instantly trying to, I was instantly trying to hide my drinking. And that was like a clear indication that something was wrong. And so honestly, like it was pretty fun for me for the next few years. I just kept drinking. I moved to Chicago, for college and I just drank all the time. I went to class drunk. I drank through the night. I put myself in really dangerous situations because when I'm drinking, like I can't think clearly, you know, it's that simple. And what happened, you know, there's kind of a lot happened. I got rheumatoid arthritis when I was 18, which is a very serious disease. And so I just had to stop drinking. I just kind of had to stop drinking. Like I couldn't, I couldn't keep up with myself. And so I had to move home and, I didn't really get to drink a lot. And so I thought it wasn't a problem. And that's my story. So what happened was I got into another 12-step program about 6 years ago, and I thought that I was a fake if I was putting something else down and still drinking the way I was. And I just want to say now that, like, drugs are not a part of my story. And if you're here and, like when I came into AA, I thought that if I wasn't doing drugs, that like I wasn't good enough. And I was so insecure about my story. And like people kept telling me, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Like we talk about alcohol, like that is our problem. And I'm an alcoholic. But I will always try to find a way to be different, to not have to look at my drinking. So anyway, I got about 4 years in the other program and, I was drinking and driving. I was, in horrible relationships with people. Like when I'm in my alcoholism, like I have no self-esteem. Like I want to date your boyfriend and your husband and I do those things and I don't like myself. And, I don't act like a lady with grace and dignity. That's for sure. And so what happened was, I applied to be a police officer and, I had to fill out a lot of information about my past and I had to tell them how often I drank and I just thought that was not their business. And so I was sitting in there with like all of these officers around me and like all of these cadets. And I was just thinking like, oh my God, like, what do I say? You know? And so I said 4 times a week, which was a total lie. And so I went through about 8 weeks to 10 weeks, with LAPD. And then, some things came up in my background and, and I didn't lie about them. And they said, you know, we're going to have to let you go for a year, but please come back in a year. We would love to have you. And I was devastated. It was everything I'd ever wanted. And some things in my background prevented me from something I wanted. And so my smart idea was just to start drinking at home. Because if I'd gotten a DUI in that time frame, I wouldn't have been able to reapply. So my bright idea is to just drink at home. And I did that. And I'm so grateful because that is really what got me here. Because I was just pounding drinks at home all the time because I didn't want to put myself in danger. And I was also dating somebody who I call it dating. I was having an affair with somebody and, he was sober. Like that's my alcoholism. Like I call you my boyfriend and you're someone's husband. Like that's not okay. And what happened, he was longtime sober. And so I would just drink. I would just drink like when we would, you know, end our dates and it was working for me. And I started to hate myself. Like I became a woman that I never wanted to be and I hated who I was. And so I reached out to friends and they said, go to a meeting. And if you don't like that meeting, go to another one. And if you don't like that, go to another. And if you don't like that, go to another. And I just went. And so I went to my first meeting on a Thursday and I drank that weekend. But what I heard in that meeting was that if you, they say right before the speaker starts that if you've had any mind altering substances or alcohol in the last 24 hours, please don't share today, but come back tomorrow. And so the following week, I remembered what they said on a Wednesday. And I didn't take that drink because I thought, I just want to share if I have something to say or if I want to. I wanted to give myself that opportunity. And so the message of that is like, we never know when someone's going to say something that's going to save our life. Like, that's why we have to show up. That's why we have to listen to people. Whether it's someone from the podium or your sponsor or your friend, like that's what I have to do. And that line saved my life. And so I've been here about 19 months now and I've worked all the 12 steps. And I went to Ohio Street, Sunday Night Ohio, with 4 days of sobriety. And I met my sponsor because somebody gave me a little folder with all the names and the meetings in it. And they wrote their number down and she wrote a cute haircut, call me tomorrow. And I called her the next day and I said, this is Laura. You told me to call you and I'm calling you. And she was like, good job. And like that, like it started from there, you know? And I went to that woman's house every Sunday. And I remember going in the first time and I opened the door and she said, how are you? And I was like, I'm terrified. You know, and she said, okay, just sit down, you know, and we read the big book all the time. She asked me to go to 3 meetings and get commitments there. And I did that. And, you know, tonight I was walking into the meeting and Tina A said hi to me from like way up high. And I just thought, that's so amazing. Like people know my name. Like when I was new, this meeting was enormous to me. And I wanted to find everything wrong with it. But the truth is, this meeting really works for me. And what was told to me when I was new is that find a way to make this meeting small. And something that really comforted me when I was coming here, and it still does sometimes, is I just envision like every single person driving here collectively. Like I'm a visual learner. And if I know that like I'm not doing this alone and we're all coming here together, it brings me a lot of peace. And if you're new, I just want to welcome you and give yourself the opportunity to change your life. And I did that just a day at a time. And get a sponsor and call that person and go to meetings. And I promise you, if you do those things, your life will get better. And thank you so much for my life.
Our main speaker tonight is Mary G.
All right.
My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. And I would like to thank Hilda so much for extending the invitation for me to come here. I would like to thank Sharon and Hilda for making it possible and for my wonderful hostess, Grace, who picked me up at the airport and has driven me around the whole of L.A. twice. And I'm delighted to be here, too, for Clancy. Clancy has played a large part in my sobriety, and I'm so very grateful to him for all he's done for me. So I will tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland, and I have Irish and English blood, as well as Scottish. And I always, from when I could think, from when I realized that I was a separate self from my parents, I always felt different. I felt like a leprechaun in a Presbyterian church. You know. It's like I was looking for magic and there wasn't any. And I never had any comfort in my skin. And I was always feeling so much inferior to everybody else around me. And I never behaved properly. And from a very early age, because I felt so odd, I didn't want to take directions or instructions. I thought I was a law unto myself. You know, I used to envision myself kind of like Braveheart, covered in blue paint, running through the Highlands shouting freedom. You know, I just didn't want anyone telling me what to do. And consequently, I never got on well in school. I caused a lot of trouble for my parents. I had wonderful parents, and they didn't know what to do with me. And I didn't know what to do with me. And I always knew that until I found alcohol to find a solution to my problem, which was absolutely and completely an unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-conscious, a pathological self-consciousness, where all I was ever doing was being aware of myself. Everywhere I went, I took myself along. And the only time I got rid and free of that was when I drank. But I never drank for some years. And my whole life up until I drank at age 25 was just a series of errors. So you see, I knew I was wrong. I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me. And the reason I knew there was something seriously wrong with me is because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. My family didn't know what to do with me. I mean, up until last October, I went back to Glasgow to see my aunts. And they look at me and they said, has that AA found out what's wrong with you yet? You know, when I was thrown out of the convent school I went to at 15 for my behavior. And I had all the bad behavior of the practicing alcoholic without the alcohol. And I just felt so different. And I saw all my friends were dating. So I decided I would try and date. Now, by the age of 16, I had become obsessed with death and I was having panic attacks, much like Bill Wilson. So these boys used to take me out and they would begin to get really passionate. And then I'd say to them, so what do you think about death? I didn't have the language then, but I think it was immediate deflation at great depth. And they'd say to me, I think you should go home now. And so then eventually I went down to London, England, and at 21 I joined British Airways. I'm flying all over the world. I have on the British Airways uniform. I'm trying to fit in, trying to be the same as, judging my outsides with their my insides with their outsides. I'm on a plane with all these people on board, and I don't like people. And it is extremely difficult. And then I decided to get married, you know, and I thought I'll find a really nice man and marry him, and then I'll be normal. Then I'll feel like everybody else does. And I found a really nice man. I married a wonderful, cultured, lovely man, and he married a figment of my imagination. And he took me to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And I had everything that I could ever want. I had money. I had my BMW in the driveway. And after a year, my first son was born. And just after he was born, I thought I was going insane. At what should have been the happiest time in my life, I'm beginning to drop apart and fragment into a million pieces. And they brought a doctor who wanted to give me Valium. And a friend came and said, give her a drink. That was my first drink. Age 25, going mad. They gave me a bottle, and they had 151 proof rum. It is so beautiful. I drank that 151 proof rum and it went all the way deep down inside of me like a piece of velvet, and it wrapped itself around every raw nerve in me, and I had been walking around with for 25 years. And for the first time in my life, my skin fit. I don't know if it's the first drink or the second drink or the third drink. But I got what Dr. Silkworth talks about in the big book is an ease and comfort. And I thought, this is how normal people feel. But it was even more than that. It was almost a feeling of ecstasy. It was a feeling of being relieved of this terrible burden of self that I had been carrying around for so long. I was outside of myself, and I was a part of everything at last. And I immediately drank on a daily basis. And after 4 years, my second son was born. And by this time, the cucumber had become a pickle. And I was causing lots of trouble. And I was not behaving well. And I would go to the country club, and I would, if someone didn't agree with what I said, I'd pick up a bottle and challenge them to a duel. And my husband didn't know what to do with me, and nobody knew what to do with me. And here's a baffling feature of my alcoholism. I love my children with every fiber of my being. And yet I am an alcoholic. And I know I am an alcoholic, and I cannot stop drinking. And I don't know what to do about it. And I began to become ostracized amongst the society I was in Jamaica because of my behavior, because I no longer know how I will behave. Bob Marley used to live across the road from me. I lived in Hope Road in Kingston. And I didn't like Bob because he was a pothead. And he didn't like me because I was an alcoholic. And alcohol is against the Rastafarian religion. You know, and I thought he had brought down a neighborhood, you know. And and I saw him one day in a garage, and he had a BMW, and I had a BMW. And he took my inventory, and it was absolutely right, because I was selfish, self-centered, and self-will run riot. And he looked at me, and he said, "You're a hedonist and a narcissist, and you don't care about anybody but yourself." He said, "You think you're so smart?" I said, "I'm known to have some intellect." He said, "If you think you're so smart, what does BMW stand for?" I said, "Bavarian Motor Works." He said, "No, man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers." So eventually I decided I would leave my husband. And I wanted to take my children, because, you see, I did love my children. But by this time, I was a chronic alcoholic. And but I didn't know that. I just thought that I was self-medicating a mental illness. I had no idea what was really wrong with me. And I knew that I had to drink, or else I would go mad. And I told my husband if he didn't let me take the children off the island, I would write something about him in the paper. And I took the children off the island. And I took my children on a journey with alcoholism, and they never touched a drop. It's a great destroyer of lives, this alcohol. And I went to Scotland, and they told me about my drinking. A man called and asked me to... I love getting married. I've done it with enormous regularity, and... You know, I love getting married. I love the part where you fall in love, you know, and everything is so beautiful, and you just can't wait to see him, and your eyes meet and your knees tremble, and it's all very beautiful. And then you get married, and, you know, for a couple of months, him and I are like Velcro. And then when that's gone, I can hear him breathing two doors down. And the thrill is gone, you know, and it's just gone. And I have no consistency. So this man said, "Let's get married and I'll take you to Canada." And we went to Canada. And I was in Calgary. And by this time, we have a Calgarian. Yeah. Oh, a few. Yeah. And it's great drinking territory. And by this time, I'm shaking in the morning. I can't get my drink up. I have these two little boys. The man I had married didn't work. He was a born-again Christian. That doesn't mean born-again Christians don't work, but he used to say to me that God would provide. And and eventually, I sent him off for God to provide for him elsewhere. And to stop the shakes, I got a job as a pharmaceutical rep. And my territory was southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and BC. And I was a blackout drinker on the road. And I thank God that I did not kill anybody, to the best of my knowledge. In those days, the police would just take me, block up my car, and drive me home where they found me. And as a detail rep for doctors, you can't exactly go in. I used to come out of a blackout sitting outside a doctor's office, and I wouldn't know if I'd been in or not. And you can't exactly go into a GP and say, "Excuse me, did I just detail that drug to you?" And And eventually I crashed my car one too many times and they fired me. And the man I was married, I sent him away because that is who I am. I have no caring. I care about nothing. I do care about my children. But I have something going on with me that is beyond my comprehension and I don't know how to stop it. And I want so badly to stop it. And my family came because of my drunken phone calls. They came from Scotland and they put me in detox. And when I was in Calgary detox, it was just me and five native Canadians. And they would hold my soup to me and my coffee to me when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. They told me that they drank because their spirit was broken. And I realized at some level my spirit was broken. But I never heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got out of the detox, my aunts went back to Scotland and I decided I would go back to Jamaica. There's something in the chapter more about alcoholism. It says the idea that someday, somehow, we will enjoy and control our drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Some of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And I was to pursue the idea that someday, somehow, I will once more again control and enjoy my drinking. And I thought if I go back to Jamaica, I will have things the way they used to be. You see, I did not know that everywhere I went, I took myself along. And that everywhere I went, I took the dreaded illness of alcoholism with me. And I went back to Jamaica. And unbeknown to me, my 9-year-old son, who suffered much from my alcohol, I never physically abused my sons, but I am a hopeless alcoholic. And he had written to his father and said, when we come back, I don't want to be with mommy anymore because she's going to kill my brother and I, driving drunk. And that little boy who was then, actually he was then 11 by the time we went back to Jamaica, we'd been out the island for 2 years. For him to make that decision, what a dreadful thing for a child. And so the father asked if he could have them for a week, and after a week I called him, and he said, you won't be getting them back. And he told me what my son had said. And I had my first suicide attempt. I took 2 bottles of rum and 2 bottles of Valium. I don't know how much I finished, but enough to kill a horse. But alcoholics don't die easy. When someone says to me, Mary, if I drink again, I'll be dead, I say, you wish. You wish. Some of us live forever drinking. And someone found me and they pumped out my stomach. And the next day, a psychiatrist came to me and told me something that was very observant, intellectually correct, and most definitely relevant to my condition. The psychiatrist said to me, you mustn't do that anymore. He gave me an admonition. And eventually I was living in an old rundown hotel in Kingston with my escorts and other expatriates. The sun had been our undoing. And what I would do is I would find someone who drank like me. And after a couple of drinks, he would tell me I look beautiful. And he would just look so nice. And then him and I would wander off into the enchanted cottage. The only thing is the sun comes up. The pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization of the behavior one more time of the practicing alcoholic. And the self-hate and the despair. And on one such morning, walking out of that old hotel, my ex-husband drove past with his new wife and my 2 sons. And he came and told me if I didn't leave the island, he'd kill me. And he gave me the money that he owed me, what were the child payments he hadn't paid for 2 years. And I went to Miami to drink myself to death. I knew no one in Miami. I did not think I could ever live without my children. My heart was broken, and yet I didn't know what to do about myself. I knew that I was irresponsible. I knew that I was not a good mother. I knew that probably my children were better off without me. But one thing is for the head and the other thing is for the heart. And it was a dreadful thing and I couldn't accept it. And I wanted to die drinking. And yet I'd drink and I'd pass out. And then, of course, what happens is you come back again and you're back conscious again. And I can't bear to be conscious, because when I am conscious, I think about everything I've lost and all the things I've done. And eventually I'd drink and pass out, and I'd leave my door open, and people would come in and steal my furniture and steal my clothes and steal my rings and everything I had, and eventually steal me. And in the end, I had no money left to pay my rent, and I got thrown out of that apartment, and I ended up living at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. And suffice to say that my life down there was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. There's no other way to describe it. And eventually I panhandled off an old woman who used to live in Jamaica and now lived in Fort Lauderdale. And she was an old English lady, and she knew my parents. And she called them, and my aunts came again and wept when they saw me and sobered me up. And I wanted to go back to Canada. And I went back to Canada, and I met a man who had known me for many years, and he thought he could help me. He's a very nice man, and I tried to kill him, and he took me to a psychiatrist, and he put me in the mental institution. And I was in and out of the mental institutions for 4 years. Classic case of alcoholism. And all the lovely drugs that they give me, all the lovely yum-yums, the Librium, the Valium, and all the lovely yum-yums, and everything. Any type of medication that will take me out of consciousness, I do not want. And sometimes they'd let me sleep. They'd knock me out so I could sleep for 23 hours a day. And I loved that life. I love being in there. I love being institutionalized because I'm safe. And the next 4 years was just a cycle of taking drugs, getting out, getting drunk, creating havoc, being readmitted on drugs, getting out, getting drunk. That was what 4 years of that oblivion and despair and thinking there's never going to be any hope. Now, they used to send me to AA meetings when I was in the institutions. AA members would bring in meetings. But they told me that they used to say to me, "Mary, do you have hope?" And I would say to them, "I have no hope." Now, that's an amazing thing, because I have a couple of uncles who were in prisoner of war camps during World War II. And they told me that what their torturers used to try and do was to deprive them of hope. And they could never achieve it. My uncles held on to hope. But glass in hand, of my own volition, I had destroyed every ounce of hope within me. Anyway, the last time I had been in there, I got out, and the psychiatrist had given me something to keep me out of prison. He said, "Finally, we've diagnosed this woman as a chronic alcoholic. And she has an abnormal personality, and she's a depressive. She also suffers from a profound sense of an inner emptiness." And I got out, and I went to court, and they didn't lock me up. And one night, I was sitting drinking myself sober. Has anyone ever been there? And I picked up the phone, and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan came, who had 28 years sobriety. And he told me his story. And he said to me, "Mary, tell me a little bit about you." And I told him, and he said, "I think you're one of us." And nobody had ever said that to me before, that I was going to be one of something. And when this man spoke, he spoke to my heart. He spoke what Bill Wilson talks about as the language of the heart. He spoke about these great feelings of difference that I had been experiencing. He spoke about the magic that alcohol can achieve. He spoke about alcohol's ability to change the whole world for me. And I understood, finally, that there might be a solution. And Stan is the one, and I tell it when I said to him, "Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mari, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches. They fit any nut that comes through the door. And those are words of wisdom. Words of wisdom. And I had 4 months sobriety and I had a slip. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. On the 9th of August, 1984, some AA people came and took me to a meeting. And I was in very bad shape. They told me I was shaking so much strangers were waving back at me. And that night, a little gal from Alcoholics Anonymous spent the night with me. She had 12 years sobriety. And she stayed all night with me. And the next day, she said to me, I'm going to leave, you know, because my sponsor said you're a loser. And I only stick with winners in Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. And I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And what I thought about was the previous Christmas. I had just got out the mental institution. And I called my family in Scotland and said, call the boy's father in Jamaica and tell him I'm not drinking and see if I can have my boys for 5 days over Christmas if I come to Jamaica. And they called back and said, he said to call him. He said, you can have the boys for Christmas. I'll come and check you're not drinking throughout the day. So we arranged. I was going down there to a hotel and someone would bring my boys to the airport and I'd rent a car and we'd have 5 days together. And they put my sons on the phone, and they were so delighted because I was going missing all the time. They never knew where I was. And they told me what they wanted for Christmas. And I went out and bought the Christmas presents, and I got on the plane in Edmonton, Calgary. And I got off in Toronto to change planes to go to Kingston, Jamaica. And I bought a bottle of vodka. And I drank that bottle of vodka between Toronto and Kingston. And when I got off, my sons were there shouting, Mommy, and I dropped down drunk at their feet. And the man who brought them to the airport said, you won't be seeing your mother this trip, boys. And I remember looking and seeing the Christmas paper because they'd been fighting to get to me and the person wouldn't let them get to me. And I remember my sons looking over their shoulder at me with the eyes of the child of the alcoholic. The broken promises and the broken dreams one more time. And that's what I thought about. And I held her hand and I said the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee. And from that moment, I've had no desire for a drink. I don't know what happened. I was surrendering to something I didn't understand. I don't understand God. If I was to understand God, God wouldn't be better than me. I didn't even know what God was. I didn't even believe in God. I was just doing what this person suggested. You know, in retrospect, I mean, after all I've learned and read in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say to you, it's much like William James wrote about the varieties of religious experience. That's the only explanation I have. You know, when he went and he writes about Jerry McCauley and the Water Street Mission and Mr. Hadley. He said he's never seen so many cases of conversion as he has from drunkards. And what happens to these people is they just seem to be broken open by despair and hopelessness enough so that the grace of God can come in. And perhaps that's what happened, but I don't know. I just know that from that moment to this, I have never wanted a drink. And I'm so grateful. And I got very active in AA, and I got a wonderful sponsor, and I did everything I was told to do. And I went to 3 meetings a day, and it was wonderful. And you know, some people think that alcoholism is just about alcohol. If alcoholism was just about alcohol, then that first year when I was going to 3 meetings a day, I'd go in at lunch in the morning and they'd say, Mary, did you drink today, this morning? I'd say, no. They'd say, okay, see you at lunch. I'd come back in at lunch. They'd say, Mary, did you drink today? No. Okay, see you this evening. And after a year of that, I wouldn't have drank, but I'd be dead. And on my tomb, it would say she didn't drink, but her head blew apart. You know, the problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind. And I have come to know that more and more. And I had a great problem with finding a God of my own understanding. Because I had been born a Roman Catholic. And then, I don't know, I think part of my alcoholism anyway was that I had separated myself from God. I used to go to Ireland every year. And my family used to take me to a cathedral. And on that cathedral, there'd be a glass case with the head of a martyred saint. He had been hung, drawn, quartered, burnt by the English. And his head had been in here for a couple of hundred years, I don't know how long. And he just had teeth, black. And my family would sit me in the front row. And they'd say to me, I want you to study St. Oliver Plunkett because he really loved God. I thought, if he really loved God and that's what happened to him, I want something more than that. But I have come to know a God of my own understanding that is beyond belief for me. And I am so grateful because the consciousness of the presence of God has become the greatest fact of my life today. And God carries me through things I cannot do myself because I truly believe that of myself, I am nothing. And eventually what happened is I went to Toronto and I got a sponsor called Rini. And Rini died with 53 years sobriety. She was a wonderful woman. And she, every sponsor I've had has taught me how to behave, has taught me well. I believe in strong sponsorship till today. And Rini took me through the steps one more time, and then my son came from Toronto, from Jamaica, and I spent time with him. And then after a few years, my sons were thrown out their father's house. They didn't get on with the stepmother, and Rini told me I should go back to Jamaica. She said, go back to Jamaica and make amends to the island. And I went back to Jamaica and got my sons going where they wanted to go. Stayed there for 2 years and worked because, you see, I did not want to leave the history that my son's mother was a hopeless drunk. And that was when I had Clancy for a sponsor because when I was going to Jamaica, I was very afraid and I became filled with all the foreboding again. And fear began to take over and ego began to take over because I'd be going back in a less than straightened circumstance. I wouldn't be one of the very rich anymore. And ego and pride were getting in the way. And Rini said to me before I left, she said, Mari, I've never lived on the street and I've never been in mental institutions, but Clancy has. She said, when you get to Jamaica, call Clancy. And I did. And Clancy said, write me a little bit about your life. And I sent, I faxed him a letter. And a few days later, the phone rang. And it was Clancy. And he said, I just got your letter and I thought I should phone you immediately. And I thought, he thinks I'm too crazy for him, you know. And he said, what is it? I said, what is it you have to tell me? He said, well, after reading this, you really shouldn't drink. And he was wonderful. He saved my life because I don't think I could have made it. And then I came back and my sons and I lived together. I'd fallen in love in Alcoholics Anonymous and got married, but you know, it just didn't work out. I loved him, he loved me, but we just couldn't live together. And what happened is we still lived in the same building and we were great friends. And one day I found him lying on the ground. He'd had a massive stroke. And I was able to take him home, and for 5 years I looked after him. And I sent my two sons off to be self-supporting through their own contributions. And my eldest son got married, and he said, Daddy's coming from Jamaica. Would you and Daddy walk me down the aisle? And we did that for my son. And then my youngest son got married in full Scottish dress and danced with me to a tune called Mama. And now I have 5 grandchildren. And I am just a very, very fortunate woman. And my life has been wonderful. Now, it certainly has been wonderful, but you know, this is an ongoing process. It says I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, which means that every morning I wake up with the illness of alcoholism. And sometimes I do things that are absolutely and completely baffling to me. I like to leave every day, leave the house, being prepared for the dragons that be out there, which are people and circumstances. But, you know, about 3 weeks ago, I got into an altercation in Shoppers Drug Mart that just shocked me. I mean, I'm 29 years sober. And I go and I want to buy 6 boxes of tissues. And I go in Shoppers Drug, there's a pharmacy there. And there's this woman, and there's a big, big a cascade of boxes of tissues. And she's pulling out all the ones with flowers on. Now, I have never cared about the external of my tissue box. But suddenly, I want flowers. So I said to her, you're taking the ones, you're taking all the boxes with the flowers on. She said, I don't like the other ones. I said, neither do I. So in the end, I got one measly little box with flowers, and she had 11. And she said to me, you should give me one because I get a dozen then with flowers on. I said, no, I won't. And I thought, why am I fighting with a woman over boxes of flowered tissue? Obviously, I was not in fit spiritual condition that day. You know. And so I have to be ever vigilant. I have to be ever vigilant. And today I sponsor a lot of women, and they are my delight. You know, my sponsor is dying right now. She's after Clancy, we suggested I should get a woman in Toronto, and she's dying, and I need her so much, and she has been so wonderful to me, and I realize about this very sacred relationship, because you see, when things like that happen to me, and when my alcoholism kicks in, then I can't think straight, and I don't see straight, and I'm inclined to go out and behave stupidly, and I can't make good decisions for myself, even today, no matter what age I am, and no matter how long I am sober. I need direction. And I try and translate my life into one of seeking direction, seeking God's guidance, and also being of service. You know, I believe we are the most fortunate people in the world. We have been given something that I think Bill and Bob didn't even realize the magnitude of what it was that were given to us. Because I have been recovered not only from an illness of alcoholism or destructive behavior with drinking, I also have been recovered from a mental condition that certainly looked the same as everybody was diagnosing it, but they weren't giving me the right treatment. They were giving me medication when what they should have been giving me was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which eventually would give me a personality change sufficient that I could go out and live in the world and live to be of some purpose. So I am absolutely delighted to be here. I thank you so much, and it means so much to me. Thank you.
At this meeting, for every 365 days of continuous sobriety, we give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you are a regular attender at this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. We have several birthdays tonight, so please sing briskly and speak briefly. Birthday people, please don't forget to pick up your candles from the cake as you exit the podium. Our first birthday tonight is for 1 year for Gaylene D.
Gaylene Denny, alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. I want to thank the Pacific Group for giving me a home, my husband Michael for believing in love, and my sponsor, Deirdre, for being such a strong example of a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. Happy birthday to my sister, Shira. I love you. And thank you for my AA sisters for coming tonight. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Gaylene. Our next birthday is for 3 years for Jen T.
My name is Jen. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank my beautiful sponsor, Tina, for giving me that cake. Hilda, for allowing me to take a cake tonight. Class of 2011. My higher power, my amazing partner, Desi, my best friend, Patty, the girls that I sponsor, Pacific Group, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Jen. Our next birthday is for 4 years for Susan C.
Hi, Susan Cook, alcoholic. Hi, I'd like to thank Julie, my terrific, wonderful sponsor, for changing my life. Thank you, Clancy, for this beautiful group and the structure. Thank you to all my AA sisters and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Susan. Our next birthday is also for 4 years for Shira B.
Shira alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor Deirdre, my previous sponsor Lydia, my AA sisters, Clancy for the structure, and all of you.
Happy birthday, Shira. Our next birthday is for 5 years for Luis R.
Hi, I'm Luis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really grateful for this birthday. My first sponsor, Tommy O'Brien, and my current sponsor, Joe Sandusky, thank you so much.
Happy birthday, Lewis. Our next birthday is for 6 years for Greg H.
Greg, alcoholic. Thank God, Ian, Frank, Clancy for all he does, class of 08. All the softball guys, Mission for being there when I had nowhere to go, and my family at home, thank you.
Happy birthday, Greg. Our next birthday is for 9 years for Chris C.
Hi, everybody. My name is Chris Cleveland. I'm an alcoholic. I'm giving thanks to a very, very loving and merciful God this evening. Thank you, Jim, for another year of sponsorship and direction. Clancy, thank you for what you do, for your example. For all the old-timers, class of 05, a couple of pockets of enthusiasm in Bellflower and Downey that have extended their hand to me in friendship and inclusion. All of my friends, alcoholics as a whole, and back there, as Charlie P. says, the baddest Puerto Rican around. Thank you, Mrs. Cleveland, for sharing your life with me.
Happy birthday, Chris. Our next birthday is also for 9 years for J.W.R.
J.W. Alcoholic. I'd like to thank God. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Robert Cook, for extending his soft hands, and his sponsor, Frank Jones, my previous sponsor, John Graff, and Aaron Giles, and I'd like to thank the Midnight Mission for opening its doors for someone that had lost his way, and I'd like to thank Clancy, you know, for pointing me in this direction. Thank you all.
Happy birthday, JW. Our next birthday is for 12 years for Laura B. Happy birthday.
My name is Laura Baird, and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank God and Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety, Julie for her sponsorship, Pacific Group, Clancy for all he does, and all of you. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Laura. Our next birthday is for 14 years for Coop K.
Hi, I'm Coop, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, Jim, for another year of sponsorship, Clancy for the structure of the group, Pacific Group, and AA everywhere.
Happy birthday, Coop. Our next birthday is for 25 years for Lawrence G.
My name is Lawrence, and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank God. I would like to thank my sponsor, Keith. I would like to thank Clancy. I would also like to thank Glenn. I would like to thank the class of 89. I would like to thank my wife, Pam, for our sober home. And I would also like to thank my mother and father who are here tonight, flew all the way out from Corpus Christi, Texas, to see me take this cake. Thank you for your love, Mom and Dad. Thank you for supporting me all these years in my sobriety. A man couldn't ask for a better set of parents, and I love you.
Happy birthday, Lawrence. Our next birthday is for 28 years for Roy A.
Roy MME, alcoholic. I thank God. I want to thank Tom and all my former sponsors. Thank you, Clancy. Thank the guys that call me sponsor. I want to thank Class of 86, PG sponsors, us PG campers, and my Bouchard brothers. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Roy. Our next birthday is for 35 years for Matt T.
Hi, I'm Matt. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Joe for being my sponsor and just being an inspiring and just a kind person on the other end of the line. And the guys I sponsor, the PG Men's Stag, my two boys who had too much homework, they couldn't be here tonight. Thank you, LAUSD. And my lovely wife, my wonderful wife, Laura, for 17 years, and all my friends here, and especially Clancy, who just has endless dedication to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, sir.
Happy birthday, Matt. That is all the birthdays. I know. That is 13 birthdays for a total of 155 years, with an average of 12 years per birthday. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please see my assistants at the door when you sign up to take your cake. We don't